Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with President Obama's visit to a mosque yesterday and speak with Aziza Al-Hibri, Professor Emerita of Law and founder of Karama, Muslim Women Lawyers for Human Rights at the University of Richmond School of Law. She shared the stage with President George W. Bush when he visited a mosque shortly after 9/11, and we'll discuss Marco Rubio's peculiar criticism of Obama's visit to the mosque, as well as looking into the recent conference in Morocco held by Muslim clerics and scholars to confront violence in the Muslim world, which Aziza Al-Hibri addressed. Then we will speak with Jamie Court, the president of Consumer Watchdog and author of The Progressive's Guide to Raising Hell, How to Win Grassroots Campaigns, Pass Ballot Box Laws, and Get the Change You Voted For, a Direct Democracy Toolkit. He joins us to discuss the flurry of lawsuits against the Southern California Gas Company over what is becoming the country's worst environmental disaster since the BP blowout in the Gulf, as an old oil well stuffed full of natural gas continues to spew out methane emissions, which so far are the equivalent of burning more than 862 million gallons of gasoline. Then finally, we'll look into the rise of Marco Rubio since his third place showing in the Iowa caucuses and speak with Dr. Susan McManus, the Distinguished University Professor of Political Science at the University of South Florida. She has followed the career of Marco Rubio for a number of years, and we will assess his chances of taking the lead from Donald Trump and Ted Cruz, while Rubio's former mentor, Jeb Bush, is spending a lot of his considerable campaign war chest on attacking his former protege. And joining us now is Aziza Al-Hibri, who's a professor emerita of law and founder of Karama, Muslim Women Lawyers for Human Rights, at the University of Richmond School of Law. In 2011, Professor Al-Hibri was appointed by President Obama to serve as a commissioner on the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. Welcome to Background Briefing, Aziza Al-Hibri.
Thank you.
And obviously, I want to talk to you about the president's visit to the mosque in Baltimore yesterday and some of the reactions to it, which frankly are kind of perplexing, with Florida Senator Marco Rubio accusing the president of being divisive, saying that Obama is pitting people against each other, which certainly I'd like to try and figure out what he means by that. But since you just returned from Morocco, where you were at a conference held calling for the protection of religious minorities within Islam. Let's just touch on that, because it seems to me to be an important conference that took place. In fact, the President Obama did refer to it in the White House the other day. And this conference came up with what's called the Marrakesh Declaration, which calls for Muslim countries to tolerate and protect religious minorities living within their borders, among them Christians, Jews, Hindus, Baha'is, as well as the Yazidis and Sabians. And of course, we already know that the Yazidis have been persecuted and murdered by the Islamic State, or Daesh, as people in the neighborhood prefer to call it. What's your sense of how that's going to resonate throughout the Islamic world?
Well, let me first make some corrections to the statements you made and additions as well. Mm-hmm. The conference is about the rights of diverse religious groups. We've decided we don't like to use the word minorities, even though they do use it originally in the title, because these people, whoever they are not minorities, so to speak, but are part and parcel of the people of the area. So to be more specific, for example, the Eastern Christians, the Christians of the East, are part and parcel of these Muslim countries. They have lived there for the longest time, and they are part of the citizenry there and are entitled to full rights and obligations and all that. However, you know, the original title of the conference was taken from using Western expressions. It's also not about Western religious minorities in Islam, but in Islamic countries. And what the conference wanted to do, and by the way, this is not the first. This is a culmination of a series of discussions and also conferences before it. They wanted to, the religious leaders, especially Sheikh bin Baia, wanted to establish very clearly what is the foundation of the relationship and the citizenship rights of the various diverse groups in Muslim countries based on Muslim jurisprudence and law. And in fact, that is a very good foundation for it, so that it's not just a matter of tolerating the groups, what we would call here minorities. It's rather that they are equal partners in the country. And that is from the days of the Prophet himself, who executed such a charter called the Charter of Medina. And if you go to the website of Karama, you will find out that you will find the text of my speech in which I point out the provisions where the Prophet says that that charter was between the Muslim tribes, the Jewish tribes, and the Prophet. And he said that the Muslim tribes and the Jewish tribes are entitled to each other's support, that they are one nation among in the world. So this kind of language might be odd today in light of the conflict we see all over the world, but that's the model that the Prophet himself laid about 1,400 years ago.
But the reality of today, for example, in the Middle East, the Chaldean Christians in Iraq have all but fled, and many have been murdered.
Yes, absolutely. And by the way, I really still, I get surprised or taken aback when I hear the term the Islamic State. It's such a misnomer. I would rather you call the group Daesh, because part of what they're trying to do is to confuse the youth. And our charge is really to clarify things for the youth and make them understand that they're being confused by this murderous group that is called Daesh. And it's not only Daesh. There are, you know, Daesh is the extreme. But in some places, people have not lived up to their religion, not only with respect to other religious groups, but also with respect to other Muslims within their own community. What we are really calling for is a return to spirituality, return to what Islam asks you to do. What is that going to take? Now, I've seen that some people responded with some sort of, you know, what is going to happen here? What can they do? It's hot air. You look, if we do nothing, we get criticized for it. If we do something, we should be encouraged for it. And I, whether we're encouraged or not, I feel that I have a duty towards the youth, the Muslim youth, to let them know what their religion is, because they have grown up, many of them, not knowing what the wonderful basis of free speech, of freedom of religion, even the democratic model of the city-state of Medina that the Prophet instituted. They know nothing about all this. And then suddenly somebody comes to manipulate them, whose name is Daesh, and because they have no other basis, they might get, although thankfully not many of them are, they might get confused. We have to do something about it. Whether some people are cynical about our efforts or not, it doesn't matter. I know that I'm going to do something. My organization is going to do something. A lot of people are going to do what we can, not only to save the groups we are talking about, and God bless the Yazidis and what they had to go through, but also to save our youth from this massacre that has been brought upon them by Daesh.
And again, I'm speaking with Aziza Al-Hibri, who's a professor emerita of law and founder of Karama Muslim Women Lawyers for Human Rights at the University of Richmond School of Law. But in terms of the religious tolerance within Islam, isn't one of the problems that Wahhabism, that's been well-funded by petrodollars and spread all around the world, in many ways, almost by definition, is intolerant?
So first of all, I don't like the word tolerant. I don't want to be tolerant of my neighbor. I want to embrace my neighbor with all his or her differences. But I know what you're trying to say. And you're pointing to Wahhabi ideology or understanding of Islam. And I would say that, listen, my understanding of Islam is a lot more inclusive, and it comes from the part of this world, which is Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, North Africa, etc., which has for centuries had this tradition of all-inclusiveness, so do other parts of the Muslim world. If there are people who are preaching otherwise, this is a mark we all know in the West. There's a free market of ideas. The only way you can fight ideas is with better ideas. That's what you have to do. And that's what we have to do. Now, I don't, you know, if you think money is a big factor in this, maybe it is. But then there must be other factors as well that we could use to strengthen our position. I mean, look at Sanders. You know, he didn't have money running. He figured out a way. We have to figure out a way, if we believe in what we believe in, that it is really a good position, a position for the 21st century, which is humanistic and all-inclusive, we will find a way to get that message. We cannot sit back and say, oh, we cannot fight the wave. Others are more powerful than we are because they're richer or whatever. We do what we can do.
But in terms of Daesh and its threat, ironically, even though in many ways there are sort of historical analogies with the way that the Wahhabis took over the holy shrines in Mecca and Medina and have been the custodians ever since in conjunction with the Al Saud family, there is a sort of first of all, Daesh says that it's the new caliphate. And I'm not sure that it's going to come out of the desert like the Wahhabis is and take over the shrines. That may be a bit fanciful, but that's certainly their intention.
I mean, look, if you're going to talk about what are we going to do about Daesh, I think it's not such a complicated situation. Mm-hmm. Look at the map. They are in a landlocked position, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Where are they getting their support from? They have clear land that is a borderline, right? There are certain countries that are around them, and the sky. If we are serious, the international community, about stopping the aid, the funding, the life support to Daesh, we will know how to do it.
Well, why isn't it being done, if it's that simple?
That's a very good question. You shouldn't ask it of me. Ask it for the people who can stop it.
Right. Well, I mean,
I mean by that the international forces, not the local forces that are struggling on the ground with Daesh and trying to push it back so that it doesn't kill. You know, Daesh killed a lot more Muslims than it killed anybody else. And these people are trying to push it back and you know, avoid the evils of what it does. Okay, where is the international community? Why isn't somebody being very serious about cutting all life support to this group?
No, your question is left hanging, I'm afraid. It does seem extraordinary to me that here we are in the United States, the world's lone superpower. We spend 60% more on defense than we did during the Cold War when we had a real enemy, the Soviet Union, that could have wiped us all off the map. And yet a handful of these Mad Max marauders driving around the deserts of Syria and Iraq in pickup trucks are the focus of all this paranoia in the United States. And apparently, according to polls, in this election year, the biggest consideration that the American people have is their fear of terrorism, not the economy and all the other things that normally dictate political campaigns. It's amazing.
And let me say, they're not just driving in some old, trucks. They're driving in brand new Toyotas, in hundreds of Toyotas. Where in the heck are they getting them from? And how is it that all these Toyotas could come through into Daesh land without anybody seeing it? I mean, this is really very puzzling, and I think the average person should stop and think about what is really going on. Are we getting the full story?
Right.
Who wants Daesh in? Who wants it out on the international level?
Well, maybe the Toyota Motor Company in Japan has to be asked that question. Yeah, you guys are selling Prius to all of these nice, peace-loving people here in California, and you're selling pickup trucks to Daesh. But let's turn to yesterday's appearance of President Obama at the mosque in Baltimore. And I must say, the front page picture on today's New York Times of Obama standing with his back to the camera greeting an absolute throng of people who are just looking at him with such adoration, I would say, and comfort. These young kids, there's a young kid with an American flag on his jacket, just staring up, feeling so much comfort. I mean, right. I cannot for the life of me understand why Senator Marco Rubio says the president's being divisive and by appearing at this mosque. What's your reaction?
Well, first of all, we've been talking about Daesh confusing the youth. Mm-hmm. Isn't it nice to have the president of the United States inspire the youth? Doesn't he have that power of the pulpit to do very quickly what many of us will take a much longer time to do? I think it was a great thing that he went there and talked to the kids and also told them that they belong, that they do not have to choose between being Muslim and American. They're both Muslim and American. And one important thing he did, which went beyond what happened in the mosque speech of President Bush after 9/11, for obvious reasons, this is a lot different situation, is that he spoke about the fact that Muslims are not newcomers in this country. You know, we've been hearing a lot recently about, you know, we don't want Muslims here, send them back. And even American Muslims were wondering, if I go overseas on a vacation, will I be able to re-enter this country? I mean, I really heard these questions asked. I mean, as if like we're shredding the Constitution at this point because we're so afraid because of this climate of fear that has been created by those few marauders in the desert called Daesh that, you know, you and I are wondering why nobody squashes them. The Muslims in this country here are having nightmares, the kids, about whether they can live a normal life. This is really unacceptable, not in America and not with the Constitution that we have. And so the president spoke about this and spoke about the fact that Muslims have been here since the Founding Fathers, and I would add even before the Founding Fathers, okay? And that the Founding Fathers themselves spoke about Islam and included Islam in their idea of religious liberty. And he quoted Jefferson. He also mentioned other Founding Fathers, including Benjamin Franklin and John Adams. And I would say there are some others, like Madison. I have done some research on that, and some of it is also on the website of Karama, if anybody would like to take a look at it. We are not here as temporary citizens. There is no such thing. And, you know, we are entitled to the full rights and privileges and duties, obligations of what an American citizen does. And so the president went ahead and mentioned all the things that American Muslims have done in this country, from architecture to the army, nursing, to law and medicine. So it's a broad spectrum of services that the Muslims have served in this country and are an integral part of this country. So what is the divisive item in that? I'm at a loss. What was Marco Rubio referring to? I don't know. If there is divisiveness, it didn't come from the president. His speech was to include Muslims and make sure that Muslims understand they are part and parcel of the fabric of this country since hundreds of years. And he wanted the rest of America to know that. The ones who were divisive were not him. He was responding to the divisive people. So I'm now at a loss about what did Marco Rubio mean.
Well, just in closing, though, the irony is, of course, that people like Marco Rubio and in particular Donald Trump are in fact basically on the same page in a de facto alliance with Daesh, because Daesh's main strategy is to split the Muslim diaspora from the countries in which Muslims live. That's why they bombed Paris, etc. That they've made no secret of that. So, in effect, Donald Trump and Marco Rubio are playing out of Daesh's playbook.
Well, to put it differently, Daesh is anti-humanistic. As a humanist, we believe that whether you're Muslim or Christian or Jewish or Hindu or whatever, we can all be brothers and sisters in the same country, co-citizens in the same country. So yes, you're absolutely right. The other view, which is anti-humanistic, is not ours. And unfortunately, some people have fallen into that trap of presenting it in a way that supports Daesh. But we're here to make sure that this will not happen. The Muslim community has been very cooperative with the U.S. government in many ways to ensure the safety of all of America. And we've certainly done our share.
Well, Aziza El-Hilbry, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're most welcome. Thank you.
And we've been speaking with Aziza El-Hilbry, who's a professor emerita of law and founder of Karama, Muslim Women Lawyers for Human Rights at the University of Richmond School of Law. In 2011, Professor El-Hilbry was appointed by President Obama to serve as a commissioner on the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the flurry of lawsuits against the Southern California Gas Company for the continuing methane leak.
To breathe, I can hold my head still with my hands at my knees. These eyes are the eyes of the old, shivering and bold. I will try not to breathe. This decision is mine. I have lived a full life. These are the eyes that I.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Jamie Court, the president of Consumer Watchdog, a consumer group that has been fighting corrupt corporations and crooked politicians since 1985. He's the author of Making a Killing, HMOs, and the Threat to Your Health. And his latest book is The Progressive's Guide to Raising Hell, How to Win Grassroots Campaigns, Pass Ballot Box Laws, and Get the Change You Voted For, A Direct Democracy Toolkit. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jamie Court.
My pleasure to be here.
And one of the biggest environmental disasters in history, certainly approaching what happened in the Gulf with the blowout of the BP rig, is this gas leak that's going on in the northern suburbs of Los Angeles. And it has been going on since October the 23rd. There has been a lot of legal activity of late. Just on Tuesday, the Los Angeles County District Attorney, Jackie Lacey, filed four misdemeanor criminal charges against the gas company, accusing it of polluting the air, neglecting to report the release of these hazardous materials until 3 days after the leak began. And criminal charges came hours after that from the California State Attorney General, Kamala Harris, who's suing the gas company, saying the litigation was necessary to hold the utilities accountable. So people seem to be throwing lawsuits at them. And what's your sense then of whether or not they are going to be held accountable?
Well, look, it's not just Southern California Gas that needs to be held accountable. It's the problem. It's also the state agencies that allowed, you know, as we have aging infrastructure, a well that's 60 years old, not to be appropriately retrofitted. This is a leak at the bottom of a natural gas reserve. It's this big cavern, largest natural gas reserve we have out here. And that's why this is the largest methane leak in California history. And it's polluting at a rate that is cutting into our global warming goals. You know, Governor Brown has articulated these, you know, huge goals of making us a renewable state as a way of leading the world. And yet, on the regulatory side, we have pipes that haven't been maintained, wells that should have been plugged or retrofitted, and this leak is all because at the bottom of this well, there wasn't cement all the way through, and in the first 23 days of October, this was injected with natural gas under high pressure as a plan that our state public utility commission had of increasing natural gas storage, which is a fossil fuel, in this huge cavern because we had the failure of a big nuclear plant down in San Diego, San Onofre, and as a result of that failure, they decided to use more natural gas to fuel electricity power plants in Southern California. And so as a result, we focus on the future, you know, Governor, what they would once call him, as Moonbeam, and we were not paying attention as a state and as many government agencies to the failure of the pipes. Now, SoCalGas knew about this, and they reported it to state officials and said, we want a rate hike to fix it. And they should have fixed it without the rate hike, but the state officials knew that these pipes were problematic and there needed to be maintenance, and they didn't force maintenance because this administration under Jerry Brown has really been about cutting the red tape, and now it's coming back to roost. So all these lawsuits, I think, will bring out evidence, but it will take time. And the problem right now is, at the end of this month, there's supposed to be another sort of relief well drilled way down below where the leak is to plug this hole. And if that doesn't work, we really need to get rid of this cavern of natural gas and end this natural gas reserve that's very dangerous. But that is not in the interest of SoCalGas or the other utilities or the Public Utility Commission or Governor Brown, which has been very protective of the Public Utility Commission, or Governor Brown's sister, by the way, who is a board member of Southern California Gas's parent company, Sempra, and the head of the Health and Safety Committee. So it's this incestuous group of people who are overseeing the utilities and the utilities themselves. It's a lot of cronyism. And it's really devastating, and so our belief is these lawsuits will ultimately compensate property owners. But right now, we've got to figure out what to do with the leak and what's safest for the people of Porter Ranch, and we need an open investigation because the Governor Brown, in January 6th, issued a declaration of emergency, getting all these government agencies that hadn't acted to do things like investigate whether it's viable to drain Porter Ranch. But none of the documents of any of this are becoming public, and we petitioned for an open investigation by the Public Utility Commission to get the documents public, to have the Public Utility Commission come down to Porter Ranch. And it's really critical because secrecy by government agencies, the desire not to regulate these utilities because there are political strings being pulled, is what's at the cause of this disaster as much as the greed of Southern California Gas.
Of course, it's secrecy that is also in part responsible for the tragedies going on in Flint, Michigan, where a whole generation of children are being poisoned by lead as a result of government indifference and government secrecy. But again, I'm speaking with Jamie Court, who's the president of Consumer Watchdog, a consumer group that's been fighting corrupt corporations and crooked politicians since 1985. But what's at stake here, not just for the residents of Porter Ranch and Los Angeles, but for the planet itself, given that methane is 84 times more potent than carbon dioxide as a global warming greenhouse gas? And so far, the gas released from this leak is about 91,000 metric tons of methane, and that's equivalent to burning more than 862 million gallons of gasoline. So this is not just an insult and injury to the residents of Porter Ranch. This is an insult and injury to the planet.
And it will be repeated somewhere because of aging infrastructure. The same problem that we had, obviously, in Flint: government incompetence, secrecy, failure of bureaucrats to take simple actions. There are pipes under Los Angeles, for instance, that are incredibly old. Their gas pipes, they're corroded. And I'll tell you, this is like literally putting billions of cars on the road. That's what it is. I mean, this is a huge gas leak. We don't know the health effects yet. They say, the government agencies say, methane is relatively harmless in the long term, but we don't know that that's true. In fact, the district attorney just filed a case yesterday, I believe, or maybe it was the day before, which alleges that some of the contaminants that have come out of this wellhead aren't just methane, but benzene, because this is an old oil storage facility. It's a natural cavern. And when the oil wasn't being stored there, they turned into a natural gas reserve. And when you have oil and natural gas mixing, you have benzene. And when benzene goes in the air, it's a carcinogen. But this is increasing our carbon footprint immensely. And because of the state rules, ironically, it's not counting under our cap and trade program as a violation of the limits were all set, and credits won't have to be purchased by Southern California Gas to offset this. So it really shows what a farce the political dance, the kabuki dance around by Governor Brown, who flew to Paris when this leak was raging out of control, to say, hey, we're going to lead the world in limiting, fossil fuels and global warming, and yet we have this huge hole in the earth emitting methane into our climate, and also we have no real good plan for fixing it, and we're going to let the Southern California Gas and the regulators who created the problem work in secrecy to fix it. That's just the antithetical of what we need, and I think what it is a reminder that if we're going to get to limit climate change, we've got to get rid of the fossil fuels, yes, and then this is a good example of what happens when the fossil fuels run away, but also we've got to get better democratic process and public process in how we deal with the utilities that are supposedly going to get this to a renewable future, and the energy companies that are going to supply the wind and the solar and the other energy that's going to replace the fossil fuels, because it's a failure of governance. This is no question a problem with SoCalGas, but it's not just corporate greed, and all the public officials are jumping on SoCalGas, as they should, to say you've got to fix this, you got to pay for it, okay, but let's take a look and deconstruct what went wrong here. It was as much a failure of oversight as it was corporate greed. And the Brown administration is very tight with these utilities. And we've seen it in a pipe explosion up in San Francisco, San Bruno, where there was literally hundreds of millions of dollars in pipe maintenance that was never that was deferred and doesn't look like it was ever done by Pacific Gas and Electric, and many of the Pacific Gas and Electric executives went to the top of the Brown administration. We saw it down in San Onofre, where we had a decommissioning of a nuclear power plant because of Edison, which was a real scandal when the former president of Edison became the president of our Public Utility Commission, Michael Peavy. He had these off-the-record ex parte communications that buried evidence about how Edison was responsible for the failure at San Onofre, and instead ratepayers were forced to pay for that. So we have these scandals with our energy policy and oversight of our Public Utility Commission, and when that happens, it really discredits the movement towards renewables, because how can you trust government to make sure the energy companies are doing the right thing? It's so bad that we just had the chair of our state in our state house, of our assembly utilities committee yesterday, Mike Gatto, called for going into the California Constitution and taking out Section 12, which provides for the California Public Utility Commission, and reassigning that role to other agencies already in government, which I think is a terrible idea, because we at least have an independent constitutional agency that can be cleaned up if we put sunlight and open meetings and Public Records Act into it, and if we put accountability of the courts, the superior courts, which doesn't exist now, into it. But to take away that agency is a mistake. Hopefully God will bend to our way of thinking, but that is how big the scandal is here. It's reached not just the levels that Southern California gets. It's reached the very core of our California Constitution, because we had the repeat of this violation of the public trust, where the government and the utilities are in bed together, and we see it time and again.
And of course, the PG&E explosion in San Bruno in Northern California killed 8 people. So the arraignment that's scheduled for February the 17th in Santa Clarita for this Los Angeles County District Attorney Jackie Lacey's misdemeanor suits and criminal charges against the gas company. Criminal charges, which could result in a maximum fine of $25,000 a day for each day the leak went unreported, and $1,000 a day for each day the well was polluting the air. This is, of course, everything else. There's been 11, I think, suits altogether in terms of the litigation that's piling on to the gas company. But I take it the fact that this is criminal makes a difference.
Yeah, it raises it to another level. But you can't put a corporation in jail. They have yet to be named corporate officers on the lawsuit, and officers who will be named later. And many of us are waiting to see whether Kathleen Brown, who is the official at Southern California Gas's parent company on the board responsible for health and safety, would ever be named in such a lawsuit. I think it's unlikely, given the political stakes here of naming the governor's sister. But if she does, that just lays a scandal right at Governor Brown's doorstep. Someone needs to go to jail, because I'll tell you what happens is, since what happened in San Bruno. In San Bruno, there was a $1 billion fine ultimately after a lot of ex parte meetings and deals hashed out at foreign destinations by public utility commissioners with the utility executive lobbyists who are attending these conferences. This all came out as part of a criminal prosecution of our past PUC president. But what happened was hundreds of millions of dollars, could be billions if you go back 20 years, on deferred pipe maintenance by PG&E, that no one ever kept track of whether it went to the pipes. So there was a rate hike that basically allowed PG&E to recoup its fine and put the money back into the pipes that it should have put in the first place. So what happens is consumers wind up paying many times when the government passes on a fine. $25,000 a day, even though it's been, 3 months, 4 months now for the leak, is nothing to this corporation, particularly when, it's going to want rate hikes. And while it might not be allowed to specifically recoup the fine from the rate hike, these companies always get their rate hikes and it all works out on paper. We need to find the individuals responsible here. And that's only going to happen with this open investigation. That's why we joined the guys who prosecuted Enron, Mike Aguirre, and Aguirre and Severson, calling for an open investigation of the Public Utility Commission so we can get the names of who was involved in government, who was involved in Southern California Gas. We get the exchanges about this problem out in the open. It's all in secrecy right now, and it's all in secrecy because Governor Brown issued a declaration of emergency directing all these agencies to do things, including the Public Utility Commission that's supposed to be meeting publicly to make these decisions and have an investigation. And now that the heat has turned up in our state house on whether we're going to vote on a constitutional amendment to get rid of the Public Utility Commission, I'm hoping that we'll get an open investigation and we'll get the names of the corporate officers involved, we'll get the names of the government officials involved, and we will send a signal by getting those people criminally on the hook. Because until individuals are on the hook, there's never accountability in these instances. And that's what needs to happen in Flint, and that's what needs to happen here.
Well, some of the pipes that you're talking about, and the one that didn't have a safety valve at Porter Ranch that's leaking, and apparently when they tried to first stop the leak, they made it worse. And it's not just leaking at the pipe, but the wellhead at the top, it's leaking all around the pipe. So it makes it very hard to put some kind of dome over it to capture it. But that's like a well that goes back to the 1950s. So that's how old those pipes are. Some go back to the 1930s, believe it or not, in that field of 115 wells. And you mentioned deferred maintenance. How much do we really know about all these pipes that are underneath all of the cities of the United States? And we know about the leaching of the lead in Flint. And some of those pipes, by the way, I just learned in Detroit, are so old that they're even wooden pipes going back to the 19th century. So we've had big breaks in water mains here from the DWP in Los Angeles during a drought, I might add. So what do we know about the state of the pipes that are piping all this gas and water to residents across this country, particularly here in Southern California?
We know they're old. We know they're not well-maintained, but we don't know much specifically. And a good example is this well. If you go to the website where the activity on the well is supposed to be available to all the public, it's completely out of date. Public records show, after a Public Records Act request, that if you go to the agency responsible in the state, this well was injected 23 times before October 23rd, on that 23rd day in October, with natural gas when it sprung that leak at its base, which, by the way, should have been cemented all the way down to the ground and wasn't, and that's why it's leaking. But that's not something that the public records online showed. And there's even some discrepancy with what's been stated, because allegedly there was 24 days worth of injection, but it started leaking on the 23rd. So there's spotty records, and it's because the PUC and the other agencies don't keep good records of the maintenance, because it's not something that's a priority. When we go back to San Bruno, one of the big things that came out of that pipe explosion was that, in that region, just in San Bruno, tens of millions of dollars in maintenance for pipes were never done, and much of the money was diverted to PG&E executives, which is outrageous. But if you go back years, no one at the Public Utility Commission or PG&E kept track of the money that ratepayers were charged to maintain those pipes. And the same is true at the Department of Water and Power in Los Angeles. The same is true for SoCal Gas. There aren't good records of the pipes. At the wells, there are supposed to be good records, and what we've seen in Porter Ranch is they're incomplete at best and misleading. at worst. And I know anecdotally from talking to Porter Ranch residents that there have been a lot of cement trucks over the last many months going into these wells. And you cement wells when you need to close them because you're afraid they're leaking or they are leaking. And I think this scandal is going to grow, and we're going to see that this is just literally a mountain of gas that's been leaking for a long time that no one's reported. And that's true of many of the other natural gas reserves we have in California, which is another reason to get rid of natural gas and go to renewables quicker.
Well, Jamie Cord, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Jamie Cord, who's the president of Consumer Watchdog, a consumer group that's been fighting corrupt corporations and crooked politicians since 1985. His latest book is The Progressive's Guide to Raising Hell, How to Win Grassroots Campaigns, Pass Ballot Box Laws, and Get the Change You Voted For, a Direct Democracy Toolkit. We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into the rise of Rubio. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Dr. Susan McManus, the Distinguished University Professor of Political Science at the University of South Florida and the co-author of Florida's Politics, One Powerful State, Young versus Old, Generational Combat in the 21st Century, and Targeting Senior Voters. She served as chair of the Florida Elections Commission from 1999 to 2003 and helped draft Florida's Help America Vote Act state plan required by Congress to qualify for federal funding under the Help America Vote Act. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Susan McManus.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm very honored.
And just to touch on the Help America Vote Act to bring our listeners up to date, that followed the sort of debacle in Florida in 2000, did it not?
Absolutely. The hanging chads and all of that, I'm sure people will remember. It's a reputation that's Florida still occasionally has to relive.
So you've obviously followed Senator Marco Rubio for a number of years, and he has suddenly gotten a new lease on life, if you will, after coming in third in Iowa, even though in his acceptance speech one would have thought he would have won. But it certainly paid off for him in terms of money flowing in. He's had about $2 million come in since then. And a number of his rivals who have dropped out, like Rick Santorum, have now endorsed him. So do you get a feeling that he's on the rise, that he, at the end of the day, it's going to probably be him or Cruz?
Well, I don't know about that. I was in Iowa. I'm an analyst for one of the Tampa television stations, and we were following the candidates around, and it was interesting because most of the places that we candidate events that we attended, we'd ask people who they were leaning towards if they weren't for whomever they were at, and Rubio's name kept coming up. And obviously there's another thing in politics is that beating expectations sometimes gets you a lot more coverage than just winning. And I guess the third thing that I've observed is the fact that the delegate count is what really matters. And when you look at it, Cruz got 8. This is out of Iowa. Trump got 7, but so did Rubio. And Rubio's numbers, according to the entrance polls, looked like he was more favored by more educated people, and certainly younger voters are attracted to him. His generational message resonates with younger people and his diversity message as well. But, you know, there's no question about it. He came out of Iowa with a much better position and down the way than he had going into Iowa, and that's obviously one of the things that Iowa can do for you.
Well, among those endorsing Senator Rubio since the Iowa caucuses are U.S. Senator and former presidential candidate Rick Santorum, U.S. Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina, key state, U.S. Senator Pat Toomey, Arkansas Lieutenant Governor Tim Griffin, Congressman Steve Womack, Congressman Rick Crawford, Congressman Lynn Westmoreland, Congressman Glenn Thompson, and the co-founder of the Freedom Caucus, Congressman Matt Salmon, and New Hampshire's GOP activist Susan Dupre. So he seems to be piling them up there.
Right, but I'm not sure those endorsements really matter too much other than maybe raising money, because endorsements matter most when it's a low-profile election, and there, this election so far has hardly been low-profile. I mean, readers turn to endorsements when they don't know as much as they'd like, but they have plenty of opportunities to hear and see even these candidates in these early states.
Well, he's as well as this bump, if you will, Rubio is certainly getting a lot of criticism. I mean, in the debates, he got some stinging criticism from his rivals. But the one person in New Hampshire that seems to be really going after him is Governor Christie, who says Rubio's constantly scripted. He called him the boy in the bubble. Do you think that's in any way affecting him?
Well, when you're surging, everybody else that isn't has to come after you. And there has been a lot of speculation that New Hampshire is one of the last hopes for some of these governors, Christie in particular, but also Kasich and our own Jeb Bush. And it's not surprising that Christie is really going after Rubio. He needs to do well in this primary, because heading into the next one, South Carolina, is not as friendly a territory to Christie as is New Hampshire. So I understand why all of these ones who are not the top three are going after Rubio, because he is number three still in this, in the polls that I looked at this morning and this afternoon as well.
Well, I must say the demise of former Governor Jeb Bush of Florida is pretty mystifying. And it was actually quite sad to see him yesterday in New Hampshire in front of an audience say to them, please applaud. Did you see that clip?
Well, you know, the Republicans in Florida who knew him well, and even Democrats when he was governor, are really astounded that he is not caught fire, and he doesn't seem to be doing as well in the debates and on the stump as he did when he was governor. Very forceful, very, you know, strong leadership qualities, took Florida through, you know, 8 major hurricanes in 2 years and developed a reputation for crisis management. And, you know, so on the one hand, they're really mystified, but on the other, as you say, they're saddened a bit that he's not doing better. But Republicans in Florida in general never have understood why we have 2 candidates in the race, and, you know, with Rubio in Florida, actually, Ben Carson and Huckabee also are Florida residents, but it's just one of those things that people ask why. And then, of course, when they say they're saddened and because he would have been a great president, the same people will say it's not time. It's just not the time for another Bush.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Susan McManus, a distinguished university professor of political science at the University of South Florida, and she was the She served as chair of the Florida Elections Commission from 1999 to 2003. So let's turn to Marco Rubio and try and get a sense of who he is. I must say I'm a little mystified by his statement today rebuking President Obama for speaking at a mosque yesterday in Baltimore, where Rubio said that Obama was being divisive and trying to turn Americans against each other. Is that sort of hyper-rhetoric that you see in the debates where he really demonizes Obama and Hillary Clinton in very sort of dark terms? It's almost as though it comes out of the sort of Cuban, Miami-Cuban demonization of Castro.
Well, you know, obviously the candidates in the debates really did go after the president and Hillary Clinton. That's part of the game in the GOP debates, and he wasn't the only one that's been really going after them. I mean, you couldn't really just say he's the only one, but without question, his background is one where he grew up in Miami, and you know, the anti-Castro sentiment is still strong in certain quarters there. But going to the mosque issue, the question there is, for anybody who goes after anyone on religion, is the question is that really a smart thing? Because religious freedom, of course, is one of the tenets of democracy. And when people go off in that direction, it naturally evokes criticism. And he obviously made that statement and is now having to probably walk it back a bit.
And what about his foreign policy credentials? Many people criticize him for being a kind of tool of the neocons who have, of course, brought us the Iraq War. And there's a lot of criticism of the fact that they've never been pulled over. They're sort of like the ever-ready battery. They keep going, you know.
Well, again, understanding the perspective of his statements, strong statements on anti-ISIS and so forth. First of all, go back to 9/11, because Florida does have a connection to that event with flight training for the pilots having taken place in our state. Secondly, of course, the foreign policy involving Cuba. But thirdly, Florida is a state with over 20 military installations, a lot of military retirees, a lot of active duty military, and when Rubio was campaigning for the U.S. Senate, which of course he won, as an underdog came and surged, there are a lot of parallels between his run now and his run for the Senate, but he was very familiar with across the state that, you know, concerns about the military and so forth. He heard them wherever he went in the state, and it's not unusual for even Florida Democrats to be very pro-military and proactive. So it is, if you understand that context, I'm not surprised that he's really emphasizing this. And, of course, the polls show that a sizable portion, majority of the Republican voters are concerned about terrorism, even more so probably at home than abroad. It doesn't look like they're really ready to jump into a war. But understanding that those elements of Rubio's background in Florida and campaigning in this state and the demographics of the state, it does at least help your listeners understand a little bit more why he's espousing what he is on the foreign policy front.
So in terms of opposition research, and there's a rumor around that Governor Bush is quite angry at his protege, Marco Rubio, and that he's sort of going to dump some opposition research in this campaign. There have been a couple of stories. The Washington Post had a recent long article about Marco Rubio's family connection. His older sister is married to a former drug dealer who was a lieutenant to this notorious drug dealer who was portrayed in the movie Scarface by Al Pacino. And there are some questions about what happened to all the money that he got, that the DEA they confiscated his home and his cars and all that stuff. But there's still a lot of money missing. And apparently this character still lives in the family home with Marco Rubio's mother and is still married to his older sister, Barbara. Is that story ever likely to get any traction? Not so much blaming him for his relatives, but basically asking, what happened to all that money, all that drug money?
Well, that story, of course, was covered in the Florida press as well. I don't know about whether it will get traction nationally. But the problem with any of these kinds of personal stories of a negative nature, and this extends to all the candidates on both sides of the aisle, is that there's so much negativity out there already that people think, well, that's just one more thing and it's just politics. So you can actually somewhat reach a saturation point on using the personal as the negative. But illegal is a different matter. So if there's something there, Obviously, you know, it can create a different kind of dynamic. You see legal issues on the Democratic side with the emails of Hillary Clinton. You see, you know, the concerns about these candidates on the Republican side. I don't really see any candidate that hasn't had a great deal of negativity thrown at them at this point, particularly the front runners, the top four or five candidates.
But in terms of the animus, or at least the alleged animus between the mentor and the protege, is Jeb Bush bitter about how his rival has upstaged him?
That is a well-known storyline here, and you hear it wherever you go among Republicans. And I'm a college professor, so I speak to a lot of different groups on both sides of the aisle, and you hear it at all of the Republican gatherings, that they're very saddened that there is this animus. And, of course, it's well-known, anyone who's a close follower of politics, how much money Bush's PAC is pouring in negative ads against Marco Rubio. He did it, and it was done in Iowa, and it's being done in New Hampshire. So I think that's definitely a dynamic that's well known among Republicans. No love lost between the two.
And do you think at the end of the day that might be a factor? And I mentioned earlier the possibility that Cruz and Rubio might, well, assuming that Donald Trump doesn't, you know, to some extent, the bubble has been pricked a little bit. But obviously a lot of people are alarmed by the prospect of him doing well. But on the other hand, people have continually sold him short and underestimated his staying power. But assuming that he somehow fades, it would be down to those two. So will that at the end of the day do a lot of damage, do you think, what Bush is doing?
Well, I don't know that it's just going to be down to these two, because you suddenly, after you get through South Carolina and Nevada, the next big siege of states is the March 1st Super Tuesday, and that's a lot of southern states, and that could be a different dynamic, perhaps. We don't know yet, but, you know, Bush has some strong support, Governor Bush, in South Carolina, but we don't know how much whatever happens in New Hampshire is going to affect what happens in South Carolina, because we've already seen the domino effect, and we're going to continue to see it. So I don't know that it would be just down to Cruz and Rubio, but anytime you have, you know, someone who has 4 or 5%, and it's a very, very close race, so the 4 or 5% that they can convince their followers that you're not to be voted for, of course that can have a negative impact on your campaign. And I'm sure that is something that Rubio's thinking about.
Well, Dr. Susan McManus, we should stay in touch.
Well, Florida's a gift that keeps giving, as you say, as we always say.
Well, thank you for joining us.
I like California.
Right, we come last in that regard. Well, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Susan McManus, a distinguished university professor of political science at the University of South Florida. And from 1999 to 2003, she was the chair of the Florida Elections Commission. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.